Hello, and welcome once again to the St Albans and District Talking Newspaper, serving St Albans, Harpenden and surrounding villages. This is the News Extra edition for the week ending Saturday the 27th of April 2019. My name is Steve and I edit and produce this programme. In this programme, we'll have our usual roundup of news stories from this week's Hearts Advertiser and St Albans Review. And, as our previous programme was our quarterly magazine, we'll have some stories from last week's papers too. We'll also have our selection of some good bits of national radio coming up in the next few days. After that, we'll have another in our series of Community Matters interviews, and this one is about the Queen's Award for Voluntary Service. Then we'll have another in-concert feature, highlighting some of the musical performances coming up in the next few weeks. That jazzy start to the programme was today's music, which is called Piano Swing Boogie, and is by Goffby. So, as usual, our first item is the news, and our readers today are Gabby, Marion, Deborah and Angela.
Hello, I'm Gabby, and my first article is about the £10,000 cost of Vandals shopping centre rampage. A teenage yob who trashed almost £10,000 worth of Christmas decorations has received a community punishment for his crime. Joshua Clark, 19, of The Close, Wiltshire Avenue, St Albans, wrecked a seasonal display at Christopher Place Shopping Centre last December in a wanton act of vandalism. According to centre manager Catherine Morris, Clark was part of a gang of youths who had been plaguing city centre businesses with nuisance behaviour over the festive period. But Clark took matters to the extreme when he tore the Christmas lights off the trees at Christopher Place, smashed the centrepiece reindeer, and picked up the accompanying sledge and threw it to the ground. She explained, "Christopher Place is always a destination at Christmas, perhaps even more than the city centre, as it's somewhere people come to take photos with our display. We always put on something bigger and better each year, but now I'm scared to do it. This vandalism had to come out of our insurance money, and the amount of damage he caused in such a quick period of time was horrendous. He went berserk." Clark appeared at St Albans Magistrates Court on April the 12th to answer a charge that he damaged Christmas decorations to the value of £9,910.80 belonging to Christmas Place Shopping Centre between December the 28th and the 30th, intending to destroy or damage such property. He pleaded guilty to the offence and was ordered to carry out 100 hours unpaid community work over the next 12 months and pay £750 compensation for the damage he caused. There was no order for costs and he will be allowed to repay the compensation at the sum of £100 a month. Helen Burridge, manager of St Albans BID, Business Improvement District, which represents retailers and other businesses in the city centre, added, "St Albans BID members benefit from free membership to the St Albans Business Crime Partnership. This network of communication between the police, CCTV room and businesses at the coalface of antisocial behaviour has enabled a number of perpetrators to be prevented or intercepted at the point of committing crimes in the city centre. Although the city's crime figures are incredibly low based on national averages, we are nonetheless committed to protecting our businesses and their property. While this needless crime should never have happened, it is important for would-be perpetrators to know that vandalism and acts of this kind are not tolerated and will be pursued through the courts."
Hello, I'm Marion, and my first article is Fly Tipping on the Increase, nearly 1,000 incidents in district last year. The number of fly tips in St Albans has skyrocketed to almost 1,000 incidents last year, government statistics show, according to the most recent figures from the Department for Environment, Food and Rural Affairs, DEFRA. Waste was illegally dumped 910 times in the district throughout 2017 to 2018. Of those, it is reported that 847 were on the Herts County Council highway and 54 were on the St Albans District Council sites. In these cases, the taxpayer must foot the clean-up bill. More than 100 of the incidents contained white goods. 16 included the carcinogenic material asbestos, and nearly 30 were large enough to fill a tipper lorry. These figures follow an upward trend in fly-tipping incidents over the last decade. For example, St Albans saw 611 fly-tips in 2010, 647 in 2011, 638 in 2012, 713 in 2013, and then 1,114 in 2014. However, these statistics do not represent the entirety of the fly-tipping problem, as DEFRA excludes the majority of private land incidents when the landowner must pay to remove the rubbish. Each time a pile of fly-tipping is reported in the Harts Ad, there is an outcry from the community, for example, when a variety of construction materials was strewn near Hartwood Forest. And most recently, fridge freezers were left on the grass verge outside a Sandridge Primary School on Woodcock Hill. Head of Community Services at St Albans District Council, Joe Tavernier, said the council investigate fly tips. There are a number of local hotspots where fly tips are often reported. We monitor these using overt cameras, and we work closely with the police to help them identify where to locate automatic number plate recognition cameras. He said they have issued 3 fines and successfully prosecuted 2 people in the last quarter. The council takes fly tipping very seriously, and we will prosecute if we can, he added. According to a British agricultural insurance company, Farmers and Mercantile Insurance Brokers, FMIB, the average cost of a fly-tipping clean-up for farmers is £1,000. Anyone who spots fly-tipping taking place should contact police on 999. Anything discovered after the event should be reported to St Albans District Council on 01727 809019 or at Waste Management Services at stalbans.gov.uk. And there's a picture in this field of all these white goods all just dumped. It looks really horrendous.
Hello, I'm Deborah. My article is entitled 19-year-old jailed for 6 years after attacking victim with carving knife at house party. A teenager who stabbed another youth with a 20-centimetre carving knife at a house party in London Coney has been jailed for 6 years. Lysian Savin of Hawkins Close in Boreham Wood was 17 when he went to a house party on Norris Close, carrying the large blade. He heard about the gathering through the messaging platform WhatsApp, but had not been personally invited. At 11:30pm on September the 2nd, 2017, the victim was standing by himself in the living room waiting for a taxi home when he heard Savin shout, "Have you got a problem with me?" Savin then attacked the victim, punching him in the head, back and shoulders. He was rushed to hospital to have surgery for his injuries, which included multiple stab wounds in his head, shoulder and armpit, slash wounds on his back and a broken finger. Wounds from the attack have left the victim with permanent scars. Savin fled the house in a car and asked a friend to dispose of the knife wrapped in clothing. Police officers later found it at the other boy's home, with the victim's DNA on it. Savin, who was already on bail for an attempted robbery, was arrested the day after, on September the 3rd. The now 19-year-old pleaded guilty to wounding with intent to cause serious bodily harm and possession of a bladed article, and was sentenced to 6 years in a Young Offenders Institute at St Albans Crown Court on April the 17th. Judge Stephen Warner was told the victim had been deeply physically and psychologically affected. A statement by the victim's parents was read out in court, detailing how their son had changed from a happy and outgoing boy to introverted and isolated. It said, We would like our old son back, who wants to live life to the full and experience things. Defending Savin, Andel Singh said since the offences his client had changed substantially, adding, "Nothing I can say can diminish the seriousness of the offence. I accept this was a horrendous act for no reason at all. Nothing I can say can express the remorse he feels." Passing sentence, Judge Warner described the attack as horrendous. "Those who go out armed with knives can expect to lose their liberty for a significant amount of time," he said.
Hello, I'm Angela, and this article is headed, "Elderly Care Concerns Are at Record High Across the County." More than 9,000 safeguarding concerns are believed to have been raised about the care of elderly or vulnerable adults in Hertfordshire during the past 12 months, the highest number on record. Safeguarding concerns are reports that relate to any suspicion of neglect or abuse of an adult, and they can be lodged by a service user, a family member, or health professional. Data shared with Hertfordshire County Council's Adult Care and Health Cabinet panel shows officers are expecting to have registered 9,609 concerns during 2018-2019. And that would be the highest number of safeguarding concerns ever registered in a 12-month period in Hertfordshire. Councillors were told that the increase reflected improvements in recording and training, which now means a greater number of concerns are counted. Following the meeting, Councillor Richard Roberts, the Executive Member for Adult Care and Health, said many of the concerns highlight areas where care was not as good as it could have been. And he said feeding back that data to care providers would make the system better. The County Council's target for the number of safeguarding concerns is zero. And Mr. Roberts accepted he would like the number of concerns to be lower than it is. Although the 12-month period has ended, actual data has only been collected for the first 9 months of the 2018-2019 year, the first three quarters. And the final figure of 9,609 is a 12-month projection based on the actual figures from the final quarter the previous year. The latest actual figures show that in October to December 2017-2018, there were 2,499 concerns raised. If proven to be accurate, the 9,609 figure would be the equivalent of 1,056 per 100,000 population. And it would be an increase in excess of 10% on the previous year's figure of 8,685. The County Council also compares its performance to other similar authorities where performance varies. In 2017-2018, Essex County Council reported the highest number of concerns, with 12,520, equivalent to 1,089 per 100,000. Meanwhile, Buckinghamshire County Council reported the lowest, with 1,270, equivalent to 308 per 100,000.
Construction con artist is jailed after pocketing £300,000 for botched work on homes. A St Albans victim of a rogue trader has said her family's lives were destroyed by a professional con artist after he was sentenced to 9 months in jail. Tony Mottram pleaded guilty to engaging in a course of conduct of unfair commercial practices under the Consumer Protection from Unfair Trading Regulations 2008. Contravening the requirements of professional diligence and failure to inform consumers of their rights to cancellation. The charges refer to three family homes the 45-year-old worked on in St Albans and one in Barnet, where Mottram agreed to substantial building work to give them their dream homes, seeing them hand over more than £300,000 in total. Several months into builds, which were only supposed to take weeks to complete, live wires were left hanging from ceilings, roofs were left unprotected to the elements, and one family discovered that a roof was waiting to collapse in on itself. Mottram ran two building and loft conversion companies, Builds Design Construction Limited and Design Build Construction Limited. The second established just 3 days after the first went into liquidation, owing money to creditors. Under the latter name, Mottram of Victoria Cottages in Cotered started to carry out building work on a St Albans home in 2016 and made the owners' lives hell for 2 years. One of the victims, who asked to remain anonymous, said, "He is a professional con artist who has destroyed a lot of lives. It's a shame he just got 9 months. He came in and destroyed our home. He thought it was okay to con us and bribe us. He told us he had cancer. He kept asking for more and more money to continue. I was trapped. We had 2 young children, and he turned their lives upside down. We had to live in a building site with little or no money to continue building our home. We feel destroyed by him. It's still with us, but we are trying to move on from this." The case was referred to Hearts Trading Standards, which carried out a detailed investigation, discovering the four families had spent an additional £200,000 just to rectify faults and complete unfinished work. At sentencing on April the 3rd, the defendant's ill health was given in mitigation, but Judge Nigel Lithman QC said there was no question suspending a sentence in a case like this.
Liberal Democrat leader Sir Vince Cable on a post-Brexit Britain, an if, not a when. The leader of the Liberal Democrats visited St Albans to discuss post-Brexit Britain with local farmers. Sir Vince Cable went to Glinwell Marketing on Hatfield Road to meet members of the National Farmers Union, NFU, and discuss the agricultural industry's concern about what may happen when Britain leaves the European Union. Alongside St Albans Liberal Democrat spokesperson Daisy Cooper, the politician met with NFU Regional Board Chairman Will Dickinson. Sir Vince said a no-deal Brexit would force massive disruption. "The biggest issue we were focusing on this morning with the National Farmers Union was upholding food standards, because if we leave the European Union, it is still an if rather than a when we could find ourselves negotiating trade agreements with America, who have much lower food standards. All the work farmers have been putting into getting British produce to really good scientifically based standards could be thrown away." He is feeling positive about the upcoming St Albans District Council election in May. "The 2015 and 2017 elections were not a success for us. I am painfully aware of that. I lost my own seat in 2015, but I think the whole atmosphere in the country has changed. People have become alarmed by the way the Tories and Labour Party have got into the hands of extreme people, and they are looking for the sensible, moderate, middle-of-the-way options which we present." NFU Regional Chairman Will said Sir Vince has always lent an ear to the community. "As a farmer, we have had a deal, because if we leave without a deal, we might need to import the lowest common denominator food that isn't safe, well vaccinated and good for the environment to meet our needs. European farmers do all these things. It is about protecting food for the consumer." Daisy Cooper added, "Nobody wants chlorinated chicken, hormone-fed beef, or the associated animal welfare and public health concerns. This Conservative government is cozying up to Trump and sending a message that British farming and food standards will be the sacrificial lamb to get a US trade deal." Sir Vince also visited charity Emmaus to discuss the rising tide of homelessness.
Campaigners brand Luton Airport's latest figures on noise complaints misleading. A Harpenden anti-noise campaign group has claimed Luton Airport's latest noise complaint figures are misleading. Luton Airport published their noise complaint statistics for 2018 last week, showing a 46% drop in complaints from 2017. Harpenden Sky chairman Neil MacArthur said, "We protest strongly about the misleading information from Luton Airport Operations concerning a drop in 2018 noise complaints. The airport was unable to handle emailed noise complaints for several weeks in 2018, which led to the need for Luton Airport Operations to publish an apology. As our members did not receive a response, then they gave up complaining as there was clearly no one listening. This deficiency on the part of the airport in responding to noise complaints cannot then be used as the basis for suggesting there are fewer complainants. It is definitely not the case, as the Luton Airport's noise mitigation efforts have so far led to no relief whatsoever." In September last year, Luton Airport attributed the delay in responding to noise complaints to departmental changes and the busy period over the summer. Mr. MacArthur said, "The Luton Airport operations' lack of resources to respond to noise complaints happened during the peak noise complaint summer season, and therefore had the most impact on persuading potential complainants to give up, as there was no one there. Actually, Luton Airport operations should have published a note to the effect that noise complaints were not being managed in the quarterly monitoring report. The 2018 figures showed that 68% of all noise complaints were made by the same 10 individuals, out of 691 complaints in total." A Luton Airport spokesman said, "Having spoken to the flight operations team, I can confirm that during the summer period of 2018, the airport did experience a delay in responding to some complaints due to an unavoidable short-notice resource issue. However, far from not listening, every complaint that we received was logged, reported, and individuals notified of an anticipated delay to our standard response time of 8 working days. All complaints received an official response from the airport once they had been processed."
And an update on Nascot Lawn, Watford. A legal agreement has been reached for the future of respite care in St Albans, which was uncertain following the closure of Nascot Lawn in Watford. Nascot Lawn Respite Centre provided overnight short breaks for children with complex needs from across Harts, but closed down in November. Harts County Council and Harts Valleys and East and North Harts Clinical Commissioning Groups were due to reach a formal agreement called a Section 75 in the autumn. Despite initial delays, the Section 75 has now been agreed. Before the closure, the County Council applied to build an extension at West Hyde Shortbreak Centre near Rickmansworth. Councillor Theresa Heritage, Executive Member for Children, Young People and Families, said, "Ofsted had visited West Hyde and given it the go-ahead. We would hope for young people to be able to use it in the next couple of weeks."
It saves their lives. Running to raise cash for Ethiopians with isolating disfigurements. A St Albans runner is squaring up to her first marathon to help people with disfigurements in Africa. Emily Eldred has been training since late last year for the Virgin Money London Marathon, which she is running to raise money for Project Harar. This charity works to bring treatment, rehabilitation and reintegration services for children and young people with facial deformities in Ethiopia. The 25-year-old runs with St Albans Striders and works out in the pool with St Albans Masters Swimming Club. She said, "I have actually really enjoyed the training. Every time I go on a long run, it is a new achievement. It is the longest I have ever done. It has been tough on my body, though. It is tiring trying to run those distances for the first time." Emily has worked for Project Harar as a programme officer for just over 18 months and has travelled to Ethiopia to see its work firsthand. While in Africa, she also trained in the heat and high altitudes. She would like to raise at least £2,000 for Project Harar, and has already collected nearly £1,500. "We do surgery for people with facial disfigurements in Ethiopia, and they are often really isolated and feel really alone in their communities. They get bullied at school, and because they can't eat properly, they are not included in community events. But when they get surgery, they go back to their communities and are confident and accepted, and it saves some of their lives. The St Albans High School for Girls alumna has run half marathons in the past 3 years, but this will be her first 26-mile challenge. She said, "I am a mix between really excited and really nervous. I was really excited when I got a place at the London Marathon because it is the most amazing marathon with an amazing atmosphere. I am really looking forward to just being there and crossing the finish line and raising as much money as I can for Project Harrah. The Virgin Money London Marathon will take place on April the 28th, winding through central London and finishing by Buckingham Palace." And there are some nice photographs of Emily, along with some of the Ethiopian children that she is raising money in order to help.
Pop-up Dementia Play aims to tackle dementia fear and isolation in our community. A play designed to strip dementia of its fear and help prevent the isolation of sufferers is set to be performed by a pop-up theatre company with a pay-what-you-can policy. Connie's Colander, written by Human Story Theatre's Gay Pool, goes on national tour next month and is at St Albans Library at 2:30pm on June the 6th and Stevenage Central Library at 2pm on June the 7th. The aim is to offer support to people who may otherwise suffer an isolation with a Q&A with a medical or care expert following each performance. The Bittersweet Play, which has funding from the Arts Council, is about a mother facing dementia with the help of her daughter. Dr. Marion Lynch, dementia expert and deputy medical director for NHS England South, said, "Connie gives us permission to laugh and cry about our own situation. The roles lost and responsibilities gained when living with dementia, and notice that we are not alone." More of this would lead to a different view on what it is to grow old and care for those who need our help. According to the Alzheimer's Society, 850,000 people have dementia in the UK. That number is expected to rise to more than 1 million in 2025 and 2 million by 2051. Sue Williamson, Libraries Director at Arts Council England, said, "An awful lot of people who are interested or touched by these issues don't feel safe in a theatre, but they do feel comfortable in their local library. Human Story Theatre, run by actors Gay Poole and Amy Enticknap, focuses on plays with a health and social care issue." Amy said, "Our aim is to be accessible to all. We pop up in any designated space with minimal set and operate pay what you can where possible. We believe highlighting health and social care issues in our productions is an exciting way to engage, entertain and educate." Human Story Theatre partners with communities and groups relevant to the issue being explored in each play. Professionals then come to lead post-show Q&As with the aim of signposting the audience to their local services. Other Human Story Theatre performances have included Flat 73, which tackles loneliness and isolation, Happy Ever After, about domestic abuse, and The Fourth Dog, about the importance of breast checking.
Charity inspires town hockey player gearing up for first London Marathon. A Harpenden sportsman has ditched his hockey stick in favour of endurance running at the London Marathon. Chris Steele is the only Virgin Money London Marathon charity representative for Bede House, a charity which provides a range of support for people living in Southwark. He is hoping to raise as much money as possible with the 26-mile run, which is taking place on his 40th birthday. Chris said, "I have always wanted to do it, and when I saw it fell on my birthday, it was too good a coincidence that I couldn't ignore." Normally playing for the Harpenden Hockey Club, Chris has been training using an 80-20 method, 80% endurance and 20% high-intensity interval training. With only a few days to go, Chris is taking on long 35-kilometre runs and even used the Harpenden Half Marathon in March to train. He said, "It is really tough. When I did a long run on Sunday, I never felt any pain like I did when I did the last 5 kilometres. It is different to hockey fitness. It's in your muscles and knees and ankles, and your legs are screaming. It is incredibly painful, but you have to get through it, and I am inspired by what I have seen at Bede House." The charity is linked with the specialist consultancy where Chris works, Control Risks. "I was blown away by how Bede does so much with its limited resources and how caring the staff were for the many projects it undertakes, which includes caring for those with learning difficulties, support for the young and underprivileged, and dealing with up to 150 cases a year of domestic abuse," Chris said. "The support is invaluable to so many, and I am therefore trying to make the most of the one London Marathon place the charity has." He said thinking about what Bede House overcomes on a daily basis puts his own little challenge in perspective. Chris lives with his wife and 2 young children in Harpenden and, despite enjoying marathon training, said he will probably go back to hockey. It's not as much fun as chasing a ball around a field.
Butterfly World, Campaigners, so New Wildlife Meadow. A wildflower meadow was sown in the St Albans Abbey orchard by a charity campaign to secure the legacy of Butterfly World. The charity Butterfly World 2.0 was originally set up as Save Butterfly World with the aim of saving the Chiswell Green project after it closed down in 2016. They have now refocused their aims on sowing new butterfly and wildflower meadows in St Albans and other neighbouring towns, and the Abbey Orchard was designated for the project following consultation with the Council and St Albans Cathedral. Butterfly World 2.0 Chairman John Horsfield said, "It's fantastic to have this opportunity to work with the Abbey. When we first started out, we wrote to MPs and other prominent local people. Bishop Allen, the Bishop of St Albans, replied within hours with a really helpful message and has been helpful since. There used to be a meadow in every parish in England, but since the 1930s, 95% of meadows have gone. We hope to make a little difference. Next year, we hope to plant meadows in Luton and Welwyn Hatfield. It's not so much replacing the original Butterfly World as using the loss of their wonderful meadow as our incentive to create more meadows. Won't it be wonderful if the now lost Miriam Rothschild Meadow at Butterfly World gives life to new meadows?" The meadow was sown on Sunday by more than 30 members of the public who volunteered to help. John said, "What was really encouraging was the number of quite young children who came and who really got stuck in. Talking to them, they all seemed aware of how important meadows like these are to the environment. I would like to thank all those who helped. Also, big thanks go to the 3 local authorities who worked so quickly to help us achieve this, and of course the cathedral staff." The charity has already sown meadows in Decorum and Hemel Hempstead and will sow another in Watford. They've been supported by 2 other environmental charities, Bug Life, who provided the seeds, and Plant Life, who provided expert advice. John said, "We are really excited about the St Albans Meadow. It's in a great location and should become a tourist attraction in its own right."
This article is by June Chapman, Chief Executive, Citizens Advice, St Albans and District. Advice Anniversary. This year is the 80th anniversary of the founding of Citizens Advice in 1939. In our early years, many of the people who we had helped had difficulties caused by the Second World War and its aftermath. Among the most common issues were bomb damage and the rationing of various food items. Fortunately, these problems are no longer with us, but there is still a strong demand for our services. Nowadays, we help thousands of people in St Albans every year with modern issues, including their rights to welfare benefits, employment disputes, problem debts, and consumer queries. I would like to ask your readers if they could help us celebrate our 80th birthday. We want to tell the story of Citizens Advice in St Albans through the experiences of the people we have helped. To do so, we are looking for any stories, photographs, or other memories people have of being helped by Citizens Advice, and the older the better. Anyone who would like to contribute can do so by contacting us in the Civic Centre in St Albans.
Magnificent Seven celebrate Special Olympics gold medals. A reception was held for seven Special Olympics athletes who train in St Albans after they won 12 medals at the World Games. Mayor of St Albans, Councillor Rosemary Farmer, met the athletes, known as the Magnificent Seven, for a reception at the Assembly Rooms of the St Albans Museum Gallery last week. The St Albans branch of the Special Olympics has 150 members who train at venues around St Albans and Harpenden, including Oaklands College. The UK sent 128 athletes to the Special Olympics World Games, which were held in Abu Dhabi from March the 14th to the 21st. The seven athletes from the district took home 9 gold medals and 3 silver medals between them. These included Lucy Warne and Thomas Miller, who both won 2 equestrian golds and 1 silver, Tom Ward, who won a football gold, Sky Westwood, who won a gold for judo, and swimmer Philip Nichols, who won a gold for relay and a silver for 25-metre breaststroke. Damia Davis and Daniel Bernard each received a gold as part of the GB basketball team, which beat the USA in the final. As well as meeting the athletes, Councillor Farmer also met Special Olympics football coach Liam Dwyer, badminton and tennis coach Nikhil Shah, and basketball coach Simon Jackson-Turner. The mayor said, "This was one of the highlights of my year in the office. It was an absolute privilege to meet these athletes who have done so well together with their dedicated coaches. I told them that the whole district can take great pride in their achievements and will be very impressed with the huge effort they put into their sports. For many of the athletes, it was the first time away from home without their families, so it was quite a challenge for them, as well as an unforgettable cultural and sporting experience. Special Olympics is an excellent charity and is doing outstanding work in the St Albans district. I would urge anyone interested in supporting them to do so by, for example, volunteering or making a donation. The Special Olympics World Games are held every 4 years, with 7,500 athletes taking part from 200 countries. The Special Olympics charity provides sports training to children and adults with learning disabilities.
This is a letter headed with the question, "Nowhere to hand in lost property?" I'm writing to thank the very kind and public-spirited gentleman who picked up my keys after I had dropped them in the road in St Albans. Through his persistence and initiative, I have been reunited with them after a short space of time. He took the time and trouble to take the keys to the council offices at the arena, but was told that lost property could not be accepted there. There is no longer a police station in St Albans, and he was told that they would have to be taken to the nearest police station at Hatfield. Clearly, this was out of the question, but realising that the set of keys included a Tesco loyalty card, he took them to the branch of Tesco in St Peter Street, from where I was able to collect them. He pointed out that there is nowhere in St Albans where lost property can be left, and I would like to bring this to your attention. And the letter is written by Michael Large of Old Harpenden Road, St Albans.
And this is the Paul Welsh column, and it's headed, "The Secret They Told Me at the Holby City Set." I've not been feeling well recently, so I plucked up the courage to visit a hospital. But as I am showbiz all the way through, it was Holby City. In fact, I accepted an invite for a private visit by the lovely line producer, Lynn Grant. This was not my first visit to such a series at what is now the BBC Elstree Centre. When the studio was run by ATV, I went along to the set of Emergency Ward 10, which was very successful in its day. Then, in the 1970s, I returned for its replacement series, General Hospital. But on both occasions, it was obvious I was just looking at sets. When you step into what has been created for Holby City on a couple of floors of the multi-storey office building, you feel literally transported into a real hospital. Such care has been taken with the whole look, and the operating theatres are equipped with real machines rather than props. The BBC is always concerned that an eagle-eyed viewer would spot something out of place. Personally, I would never know the difference, as I was brought up on television westerns, when before an operation, the patient was given a few slugs of whiskey and told to bite on a bullet while being held down. In fact, when they shoot an operation, the actors are supported by real operation theatre nurses in the scene and are watched off camera by a consultant surgeon to prevent errors. It's that kind of care that makes Holby City special and why it's around still after 20 years. Even when they planned their anniversary episodes shown earlier this year, in which they joined up with Casualty, they made a change from the proposed disaster that is the mark of an anniversary on screen. The idea was to plunge the hospital into crisis due to a power blackout, until the NHS told them that was impossible due to elaborate backup systems, which in real life must be comforting to know. So they changed it to a cyber attack on their computer systems, which is highly unlikely, but just possible for the purposes of creating drama. Only a handful of Holby City staff are full-time BBC employees nowadays, with most of the production staff freelance, in contrast to the days of the ATV series. They aim to film 6 minutes of screen time each day on average, and shoot with one camera, rather like a movie. Sometimes two crews might be shooting on different sets, and on occasions an actor might have to go from one to another. Being an actor on Holby City is a challenge. It's not enough to know your lines, hit your marks, and avoid bumping into the scenery. Rehearsals are limited and budgets tight, but quality remains the aim, and it's obviously appreciated by its loyal audience of millions. On my visit, I was able to discover a secret. So this is just between us. As part of the 20th anniversary celebrations throughout this year, one character will die and several former stars will be making guest appearances. My lips are sealed, but I hope viewers will continue to enjoy Holby City for years to come, and I'm rather proud that it's made in Boreham Wood. Whilst there, I was tempted to go for an audition, but was told they had enough corpses already. I was thinking of playing a rather tipsy member of the NHS Trust, which would not require much acting, but would add that touch of realism.
And that's the end of the news. And now the list of people whose deaths were announced in the last 2 weeks' editions of the Hearts Advertiser. John Bedford, aged 72 years. Linda Fawcett, aged 73. Lisa Gratt, aged 46. Eric Kerslake, aged 87. Peggy Woods, aged 95. Stanley Birch, aged 90. Chris Frankish, aged 32. Graham Fryer, aged 88. Nellie Holmes, aged 99. Terry Laver, aged 83. Tessie Lysett, aged 87. Margaret Norris, aged 74. Christine Pinney, aged 70. Margaret Rankin, aged 84. Michelle Taylor, aged 48. Jim Thorpe, aged 73. And Donald Tominey, aged 87. Now, another little bit of our musical offering, and then we'll have our selection of national radio highlights for the next few days. Thank you.
And now for a look at some of this coming week's radio highlights, starting with Saturday the 27th of April. First off, drama. Eric Ambler was a master of the spy genre, influencing John le Carré, Alfred Hitchcock and Graham Greene. At 2:30pm on Radio 4 is a fact-based drama about the pairing of Ambler and US film director John Huston to make a documentary to support the Allied war effort, entitled Ambler, The Battle of San Pietro. Then, at 6:30pm on Radio 3, Opera on 3 is the Olivier Award-winning Royal Opera House production of Janáček's tragic work, Katia Kabanova. Katia is unhappily married to Tichon, and while he is away, she and her neighbour Boris meet and fall in love. Finally, for Saturday 27th of April at 8pm on Radio 4 is Archive on 4, 1979, Democracy's Nightmares. A look back at the political fears and hopes swirling on the left and right alike in the period leading up to Margaret Thatcher's 1979 election victory.
We come now to Sunday the 28th of April. At 11:15am on Radio 4 is The Reunion. The Scottish Parliament celebrates 20 years mid-May, and among those gathered together by Sue McGregor to discuss how it came about are former First Minister Henry MacLeish, MSP Wendy Alexander and Scottish Lib Dem leader Jim Wallace, repeated on Friday the 3rd of May at 9am. Then at 3pm on Radio 4 is Eric Ambler's Second World War thriller, Journey into Fear. This is the first episode of a two-part adaptation about an engineer who is marked for death while working for the Turkish government. Poetry Please is at 4:30pm on Radio 4, and this week Roger McGough is joined by poet John Hegley and comedian Arthur Smith, with readings of poems by Adrian Mitchell, Fiona Benson and John Cooper Clarke, repeated on Saturday the 4th of May at 11:30am. Finally, Drama on 3 at 7:30pm on Radio 3 is Shakespeare's rarely performed 1634 tragicomedy based on a tale by Chaucer, The Two Noble Kinsmen.
Now for a look at some of those programmes which are broadcast each day at the same time. Book of the Week at 9:45am each day on Radio 4 is Underland by Robert McFarlane. The author reads from his book in which he reflects on the worlds beneath people's feet, beginning by recalling a journey to a cave in the Mendips. Then the 15-minute drama at 10:45am each day on Radio 4 is Curious Under the Stars, a comedy drama set in a mysterious Welsh coastal village. Composer of the Week on Radio 3 at 12 noon is Amy Beach, an American born in New Hampshire in 1867. The first programme looks at how she responded to Dvorak's call for Americans to establish their own classical music tradition, but chastised him for his presumption that only men could lead the way. At 12:04pm on Radio 4, Anton Lesser reads from Ian McEwan's latest novel, Machines Like Me, in which the author poses the question, what would happen if artificial intelligence came to resemble our own so closely that we couldn't tell the difference? Then, at 1:45pm each day on Radio 4 is The Five Faces of Leonardo. In the week of the 500th anniversary of Da Vinci's death, this series looks at the artist's virtuosity and re-examines it through the eyes of contemporary experts. Finally, at 10:45pm each day on Radio 3 is The Essay, More Letters to Writers. Ian Sansom has a series of imaginary correspondences with the world's great writers, beginning with Dante.
We look now at highlights for Monday, 29th of April. At 11 a.m. on Radio 4 is Surviving McCarthy. Tens of thousands of US writers and academics were fired from jobs or blacklisted following accusations they were communists during the McCarthy era of the 1950s. Science writer Azan Massoud tracks some of them down. Then at 2:15 p.m. on Radio 4, the final part of the drama, The Ferry Hill Philosophers, followed at 3 p.m. by Brain of Britain, which is repeated on Saturday the 4th of May at 11 p.m. At 4:30 p.m., also on Radio 4, Beyond Belief this week considers the aftermath of the Notre Dame Cathedral fire, which shocked believers and non-believers alike. Finally, for Monday, 29th of April, on Front Row at 7:15 p.m. on Radio 4, the shortlist for the Women's Prize for Fiction is announced, followed by a discussion on the prize itself.
On to Tuesday, the 30th of April. The drama at 2:15 p.m. on Radio 4 is What's He Building in There? Kate is desperate to get her gaming brother out of the family attic before the house is sold, and is forced to confront uncomfortable truths about their past. At 3:30 p.m. on Radio 4, Costing the Earth this week is entitled The Youth Are Revolting. The youth strikes around the world have focused people's attention on global warming. But are young people really changing the narrative on climate change? Finally, for Tuesday the 30th of April at 7:30 p.m, Radio 3 in Concert is a Spanish-themed concert recorded last week at the Barbican Hall in London. Ravel's Rhapsody Espanol and Bolero L'Heure Espanol.
We come now to Wednesday the 1st of May and start with the curious cases of Rutherford and Fry at 9:30 a.m. on Radio 4. Entitled The Lunar Land, this is the second of a two-part episode to mark the 50th anniversary of Apollo 11. What would life be like if we had more than one moon? Repeated at 8:45 p.m. that evening. Just William fans will enjoy Martin Jarvis performing a pair of Rich Mal Crompton comic classics in Just William Live at 11:30 a.m. on Radio 4. This week it's William and the School Report. Then at 6:30 p.m. on Radio 4 is Simon Evans Goes to Market. This week a look at Karl Marx's influence on the course of 20th century history. Then at 8 p.m, still with Radio 4, Across the Red Line returns bringing together figures from opposing sides of an argument. This week, former chair of the National Trust, Simon Jenkins, and historian Zaria Massani debate whether cultural artefacts should be returned to their countries of origin. Over to Radio 3 at 10 p.m. for Free Thinking. How do writers evoke a sense of place so vivid that you feel you are inhabiting it? Labour politician Alan Johnson did this beautifully in his memoir, This Boy, and won the Royal Society of Literature Ondaatje Prize. Together with three other fellow prize winners, he discusses this aspect of literature.
On to Thursday, the 2nd of May. At 11 a.m. on Radio 4, Crossing Continents this week looks at how a movement of young people have begun to occupy abandoned villages to reverse the decline of the Spanish countryside. Plus, how does a lonely Spanish shepherd find love when single women have left for the city? The afternoon concert at 2 p.m. on Radio 3 is Mozart's opera Le Nozze di Figaro, a single day of madness in which Count Almaviva's schemes to exploit those around him backfire and he repents his devious ways. The drama at 2:15 p.m. on Radio 4 is Foreign Bodies Keeping the Wolf Out, the first episode of a three-part dramatisation of Philip Palmer's crime drama set in Hungary during the Cold War. This is followed at 3 p.m. by Open Country, in which Ian Marchant visits the Sussex Weald and learns about the area's history as the epicentre of the arms trade. Repeated on Saturday the 4th of May at 6:07 a.m.
Finally, we come to Friday the 3rd of May. At 11 a.m. on Radio 4 is Beyond Tara and George, a follow-up programme to last summer's Radio 4 series on East London rough sleepers. Last year, there were nearly 600 deaths on the streets of the UK. Audrey Gillen catches up with Tara and George to see how they are coping with the winter cold and asks what it would take to prevent these unnecessary deaths. This is followed at 11:30 a.m. by a new series, Hugo Rifkin's Search for Power. Times journalist and regular panellist on the News Quiz, Hugh Rifkin, has met many powerful people, including prime ministers, royalty and billionaires. But who is truly ruling the world? Finally, let's wind down the week with Radio 2's Friday Night is Music Night at 8 p.m. This week it comes from the Cheltenham Jazz Festival with the BBC Concert Orchestra and the Guy Barker Big Band. Special guest singers include Georgie Fame and Vanessa Haynes. And there's more jazz for the night owls amongst us. If you're still awake at 3 a.m, join Jamie Cullum on Radio 2 as he shares his love for jazz and the cinema, starting with the earliest days of jazz on film and the struggles faced by black artists. That's Jazz at the Movies.
And now, the next in our series of Community Matters interviews. Rob Pearman talks to Penny Williams, Deputy Lord Lieutenant of Hertfordshire, about the Queen's Award for Voluntary Service.
Over the last few months, I've chatted with a number of different people who represent voluntary groups, charities, social enterprises. Some of those organisations or operations have actually won the Queen's Award for Voluntary Service. You may also remember that I was talking with Robert Voss, the Lord Lieutenant of the County of Hertfordshire, some months ago, and we mentioned then the award scheme. And I'm delighted that Penny Williams, who is responsible for the management of the award scheme, is that the way to put it, as a Deputy Lord Lieutenant?
Yes, I run the scheme for Robert, but Robert has the final say-so in which organisations go forward, and I have a team of deputy lieutenants. Each of them pretty well responds to a different borough and links up with the mayors and the people in those boroughs to try and find organisations which would be appropriate to be put forward.
So is this a process where you and that you describe the team of deputy lieutenants going out looking, or is it people contact you saying, I want one of those?
It's more us going out and looking and trying to either persuade people that they should be put forward and suggesting they then find people, or otherwise, the other deputy lieutenants and I all go out and interview each new mayor each year and try and persuade them at the end of their year to reflect on all the wonderful groups they've seen, whether there is one in particular they feel should be put forward, and we ask them to put them forward.
Okay. Now, let's go back to square one, as it were, the Queen's Award. Obviously, it originates with the Queen. Was it at the time of her Jubilee that she created this scheme?
Yes, it was created in 2002, the year of her Jubilee, and she decided that individuals who did wonderful work in the community were being honoured, but the many voluntary organisations and charities that worked in the communities in England, Wales, Scotland and Northern Ireland, they should also be celebrated. So that's why the Queen's Award for Voluntary Service was created.
So it's been running for about 15 years now, is that right?
I think it 2003 started. Was yeah. The first awards. Mm,
okay.
Yes.
And are we talking nationwide, hundreds and hundreds of organisations or voluntary organisations, obviously?
Well, last year I think it was over 500 to 600 organisations were put forward, and 250 nationwide actually received the Queen's Award.
And this is done through the Lord Lieutenant in each county. That's the because that person stands as the representative of the Queen.
Yes.
And therefore it is nominated through your internal process. He or she gets the last word, as it were, consultation.
We get the information at the beginning of October. I then allocate the different organisations to various members of my team. We then really spend the whole of the autumn looking at them, talking to the organisations, talking to the people who've nominated and the two referees as well. Also, we will look at other organisations that are similar and try and assess whether they're particularly exceptional in what they do, both locally, regionally and nationally. For example, Heartswatch, which got it this year, I talked to the national organisation, and Neem in the Police and Crime Commissioner's office, she did a survey for me of a lot of different areas to find out whether they were doing something exceptional compared to Neighbourhood Watch schemes in other county areas.
So you would look at them within the context of what they're doing. You're not trying to compare one type of voluntary organisation with another type and say, is this more useful to society? It's about how they're perceived in what they're doing.
Yes, it's within the context of what they do, perceiving whether what they do is exceptional compared to other organisations within the county or regionally or nationally.
Okay, so let's talk about the sort of organisations which have been granted this award. And I'm conscious that of those that I've interviewed, two, and they both raised this because they were both delighted to have got it. It was the Crescent, which of course is the HIV/AIDS Advice Centre, and the other was Rennie Grove. Are those the sorts of ones that you would expect? And if so, why do you think they got it?
Rennie Grove got it, that's last year, because of the amount of work that the volunteers do and what the volunteers consider should happen is taken into account. And obviously the board of trustees also was very operational as well. Some organisations, it might be one person who runs it who's inspirational, maybe chooses the board of trustees but is really the person who steers it. Whereas we're looking at organisations where the trustees really steer the organisation, where the volunteers have a voice as well, and where often it has been actually started up by a volunteer. It's come from volunteer need.
You mentioned just now that the individuals who perform well in society, as it were, can be awarded an MBE, OBE, CBE, whatever. In a sense, is this a group equivalent of what those awards mean?
Yes, it is. It is considered the equivalent of a national individual honour. It is the highest award given to local volunteer groups across the UK to recognise outstanding work done in their communities. Any group doing voluntary work that provides a social, economic or environmental service to the local community can be nominated. So it's quite wide. Now includes media, so mass communication, television, radio, newspapers, community magazines, social media, journalism, all those sorts of things, and also digital, such as websites, technology-based social media, IT training. So it's widened. With current technological developments, they've had to widen because a lot of social and community groups are now going into that.
If an organisation is granted this award, what do they actually get for it, apart from the PR and the prestige?
They're required to organise a ceremony where the Lord Lieutenant or one of his representatives comes along. So in fact, I'm doing the Heartswatch one this year. And they get a certificate and they get this glass domed crystal. When I went to Wear in Bloom, which got it last year, they had already got it emblazoned on all their T-shirts. You have the little strap line you can put on everything. And in fact, St Albans Musical Museum have already got it on their website. So yes, it's something you can put on everything.
Now, you're working across the whole of Hertfordshire, so although you're actually a St Albans resident and you know St Albans well, you have got to know the other districts within the county.
Yes, and also because of my various voluntary roles I've had in the county and working roles, I do know a lot of the county anyway.
What were those roles?
Oh, I'm a trustee of the Hertfordshire Domestic Abuse Helpline. I'm a trustee of St Albans and Hartsmere Domestic Abuse Forum. I'm chairman of a small housing charity in St Albans called Vincent's. I do some other things as well. I can't think. I'm also vice chairman of Amnesty, and there are one or two other things I'm involved with.
Yes, and you were also a magistrate, I think.
Yes, and also I've been a trustee of Hertfordshire Community Foundation for, it will be 9 years in September.
Anything like the Lord Lieutenancy can, I hope he'll forgive me if he says this, it can always be a sort of self-fulfilling thing. It's people you know.
The steer from the palace is that they want the lieutenancies to be much more diverse and represent their local communities. And obviously the more that Robert Voss's Lord Lieutenant and the Deputy Lieutenants go out and actually go into the communities, the more they're going to be aware of key people in the communities who might well be possible candidates to be Deputy Lieutenants.
Yes, and so that you're all spread across the district. And you have a particular responsibility for the Queen's Award, which we will come back to in a moment. Do other deputies have particular responsibility for other areas of the work?
Robert has actually created a number of special interest groups within the lieutenancy. So there's one on media, there's one on business, there's one on health, there's one on the individual honours, there's one on youth. there are a number of other special interest groups all feeding in information, and also we have area groups as well. And certainly, I mean, Lady Verulam, when she was Lord Lieutenant, she really started the ball rolling in creating a more diverse lieutenancy.
And that includes a number of representatives of different faith groups, which is quite interesting because, of course, as society changes, you need to reflect those changes. Now, let's go back to the process of the Queen's Award again. So there you are. You've got this structure internally within the lieutenancy of how it can be made to operate, but you're still reliant upon other people, and not just the mayors, but other people within the community.
Anybody can nominate an organisation as long as they're not a volunteer at that organisation or a paid employee. So, for example, clients can nominate, or be, if you like, the referees as well. For the Crescent, which you referred to, what happened was that the nominator, can't remember who that was now, but the two people who then supported that as referees were both clients of the Crescent, and they could remain anonymous. Obviously, they had to remain anonymous. As a nominator, they need to know your name, but if it's appropriate, you can remain anonymous as a supporting referee.
And so then your team or somebody within your team would then go and look at the Crescent in detail and say what it does and interview various people and perhaps talk with other clients with the same confidentiality as before. And that would build up a picture, and then that would be one of the ones that was submitted to the process.
In fact, I actually was one of the two assessors for the Crescent, and we not only talked to the chairman and the people there. I went to an open day there when we talked to lots of people there. We also talked to the medical team that works with the Crescent to see how the Crescent were viewed by them as well.
Other groups might not be of a similar nature. Do the unknown ones get a chance to come in, do you think?
Oh, absolutely. And one I would put forward as an example is the St Albans Musical Museum, which got it this year.
Which we used to know as the St Albans Organ Museum,
is that right?
It used
to be known as the Organ Museum.
Yes.
And to my shame, I never visited it until I actually had to assess it and realise what a wonderful organisation it was. Started by a man who was a local builder, who was an enthusiast for all these wonderful organs and musical devices. Before he died, he wanted to ensure that all these musical machines would actually survive, and created a trust. And it was actually in his builder's yard where it's survived for 40 years now. And the people there are wonderful. They're so enthusiastic, but haven't really broadcast themselves. They've now got a PR person there. And I hope that the Queen's Award will increase their visibility. It wasn't anybody who was particularly involved with them who actually put it forward. I looked up on the internet, looked at all the other organ museums in the country. It was the only one that was a charity. They were either otherwise private or they were business enterprises. So this really stood out. And then I talked to a number of other people who are involved nationally in organ museums as well to get an understanding. So that's the sort of thing you do. And it can be such a wide variety of different organisations we're looking at. When I went, they had a group of people who had Alzheimer's. So they're looking at groups that actually would have benefit from enjoyment of actually going. They're not just people who might just be interested. And there are lots of family groups there. There are about 80 to 100 people there. Mm-hmm. And it was a real buzz. And then they have concerts, I think, on a Saturday night. And then they run other events as well there.
And it's in St Albans?
Just next to Camp School. It's down a little roadway, but pathway, you wouldn't really notice it.
Yeah. I looked up, as I always do, a little bit of research, and I'm afraid Wikipedia is a very great source of research. Hence, I discovered that it was the Queen's Golden Jubilee Award for voluntary service by groups in the community. That's the full name. Give us a bit more about the process and about how it works.
All the lieutenancies are told at the beginning of October what organisations have been put forward. They have to have been put forward by the end of the second Friday in September. That is the final date for organisations to be assessed in the following year. There are only two people who run the office nationally in the Department of Culture, Media and Sport. So obviously they would prefer organisations to be put forward earlier. So there's a steady stream of organisations that they're checking for the criteria before they send them out on October the 1st. So we get them October the 1st. I then allocate the different organisations to members of my team to go and investigate. We get together in December, look at everything that we have looked at and have drafted the forms we need to fill in, and the citation, which is, if you like, the summary of what we've considered about them. I organise a meeting with Robert Voss, Lord Lieutenant, by the end of the second week of January. And he then will decide which ones he will recommend, whether he wants to fine-tune any of our writing. Then the assistant clerk to the lieutenancy, Siobhan Curran, has 2 weeks to get them all finally into the Department of Culture, Media and Sport by the end of January. And then from the end of January through till about mid-April is when there are all sorts of subcommittees that look at the different aspects of the different nominations. And we will know by about mid-April which ones have actually been awarded the Queen's Award for Voluntary Service. They are told they can't say anything till 2nd of June, which must be quite difficult. And then the ones who don't get it, they're let know slightly later. And then there might be other organisations which the National Committee decide they want some more information on. They're known as the pooled awards. So there'll be specific questions we need to go back and answer. And there have been two this year. I won't say what they are, but there are two organisations this year we've got to do more work on.
And that would be for perhaps the next year?
For the
year
following year.
Okay.
Yes.
So even if you don't win a prize, it's not all is not lost. But logically, there must be a number that, you're filtering down from a larger number to a smaller number, and then it gets filtered down again. So there are quite a few that don't get the award,
yes.
Obviously.
There were two this year that didn't get it.
Well, locally?
Yes, locally. We had five that got it,
okay.
Two where they wanted more information, so they'll go into next year's pot, and two that didn't get it.
Right.
But what is rather nice is that Frances Button, when she was chairman of the County Council, initiated a reception in March for all the organisations which were nominated for a Queen's Award, which is lovely because otherwise the ones that don't get it don't get anything. They just get us visiting and that's it, and then a letter saying wonderful work but not quite. And Councillor Richard Thake, who will be chairman for the next 2 years, he has carried on that reception, and certainly every time we've done it there's been a real pleasure from all the organisation that there's been a county recognition as well.
Even though at that stage they don't know.
They don't know. And we don't know.
No.
If I can just say that, including this year, we will have had 36 awards. Over the 15 years since
right.
It started.
So it sounds like that. Is that going up each year? Is there a pattern?
It is going up. What happened when I took over, I had a meeting with Helen Nellis, who is the Lord Lieutenant for Bedfordshire, and Judith, who runs the scheme for the Lieutenancy there, because I was aware we weren't doing particularly well. And that gave us a whole load of clues as to how to move forward to try and encourage more organisations to be put forward.
And do you think it was just that perhaps not enough people, groups, knew of the scheme?
I don't think enough groups did know, or people who could nominate knew enough. General public didn't know. So what we aim every time now somebody is awarded a Queen's Award is that when they do their celebration, that actually that gets into the local paper as well, because we really want it into the local news organisations to celebrate.
That's right. And, of course, on local radio.
So the organisations that got this year, I have mentioned them some already. There was Hearts Watch.
That's Neighbourhood Watch.
That's Neighbourhood Watch. That's the County Neighbourhood Watch. Mediation Hearts, which does a lot of mediation services, goes into schools, goes into all sorts of places, and it's been very creative. Samaritans of Southwest Hearts, which also has a link with the Mount Prison and trains prisoners as well to act as listeners. So that's really important. There's the St Albans Musical Museum we've talked about. And there's also the Waterways Experience, which has two, if not three, canal boats and is for people with disabilities to be able to go onto the water.
Yes. And those are the ones that went forward this year?
There were more that went forward.
Oh, those are the winning the
those
ones.
Those are the ones who got it. Two further ones didn't get it, and they're two they want more information on.
Well, that's fantastic. So the key message is, if you know an organisation that you think deserves this award, you should start to nominate fairly quickly this year, because you've only got to the end of September, as it were, or is it less than the end of September?
And if I can say just some basic criteria, it has to be made up of two or more people. It must have been operating for a minimum of 3 years, not necessarily as a charity. It can be any voluntary group or company incorporated charity. So it's those sort of three strands. More than half the people who work for the group must be volunteers. More than half the group's volunteers must have residence in the UK. And it must have all, obviously, the appropriate insurances and have all the safeguarding and GDPR, whatever we like to call it.
The data regulations, which is driving us all mad. Yes, absolutely.
So those are the basic criteria.
Yeah, certain policies must be in place, must be following certain procedures. Mm. The average charity knows all about this now. Great, Penny. Thank you very much.
Thank you very much indeed, Rob. Thank you. And I look forward to you continuing to publicise the Queen's Award Voluntary Service.
Well, thanks to Penny Williams for that information about the Queen's Award. If you want to find out more about this award and the system and how you can nominate a group or be involved in some other way, their website where it has all the information is qavs.direct.gov.uk. Of course, you can also have a look at the Lord Lieutenant's own website, because the information can be traced through that as well. And that website is lord-lieutenant-hearts.org.uk. And of course, I interviewed the Lord Lieutenant himself some months ago. So that's another podcast sitting in the Community Matters section of the Radio Verulam website, radioverulam.com.
It's time for In Concert. David Ireson tells Jill Burridge about some of the musical performances coming up in the area in the next few weeks.
Hello, it's Jill Burridge here, and I'm joined in the studio by David Ireson, which means that we're going to look ahead to some of the musical events and concerts and things that are going to be happening over the coming weeks.
Indeed we are.
Yes, welcome, David.
Thank you.
Fresh from Easter singing,
yeah.
which was a massive commitment, was it?
Well, there is quite a lot of it, yes. Mm. Yes.
So, and just a reminder for you of a concert that we actually mentioned on our last preview session, which is Saturday the 27th of April. St Albans Chamber Choir are performing in the Cathedral.
Yes, they're Golden Jubilee celebrations with the choir from Worms in Germany, the Wormser Kantorei, and they're singing Mozart Coronation Mass, Vaughan Williams, Donar Nobis Pacem, and Handel Zadok the Priest. A great collection of music for that collaboration, I think.
It sounds a good one to go to. So 27th of April, St Albans Chamber Choir in the Cathedral, and it starts at 7:30. So on the 11th of May, Saturday the 11th of May, there are two concerts. This often happens, doesn't it?
Yes.
That we're going to be talking about. First of all, I think you're heading to Harpenden, to St John's Church, and the music makers of Harpenden.
That's
are
right.
Performing.
A group that we haven't mentioned much before.
No.
Funnily enough, the weekend before, the weekend after Easter, I couldn't find any concerts on at all. Which is very unusual for this part of the world, but I suspect most people go away after Easter, so nothing much was happening. So, yes, the music makers of Harpenden are in St John's Church at 7:30 with a programme which finishes at 9 o'clock. So if you don't like late nights, this could be the programme for you. They're singing a programme based on Song of Solomon, and including music by Thomas Tallis, William Walton, Eric Whittaker, John Ireland, Thomas Morley and Gerald Finzi, among others. The theme was inspired by the Old Testament book, the Song of Solomon, and is, of course, on the subject of love. There are many well-known pieces in the programme. For example, Tallis's If Ye Love Me, which we'll hear the beginning of now.
That's so beautiful, isn't it?
It's lovely. It's lovely. To me, it encapsulates what I think is often true of really great music, is that it's very simple.
Mm.
If you look at some of the most wonderful motets by Byrd, like Ave Verum, they're basically very simple. And I think there is great beauty in the simplicity, really.
Mm. Serene, I think, too.
Yeah. They're also singing John Ireland's Greater Love, William Walton's Set Me As a Seal Upon Thine Heart, Patrick Hadley's Rise Up, My Love, and Gerald Finzi's My Lovely One. All these are favourites of choirs and audiences. There is also some music by Bob Chilcott and Thomas Morley's Jolly Madrigal, Now Is the Month of Maying. The actor Paul Manuel will also read love poetry, both from the Song of Solomon and from William Shakespeare. So that's a concert at St John's on Saturday the 11th of May, finishing at 9 o'clock.
Yes, starting at 7:30 and finishing at 9. So, yes, absolutely. Now, the other one is in St Albans, the other concert that day.
It is, and that's going to be a rather longer concert. The orchestral concert, the same night, May the 11th, is given by the St Albans Symphony Orchestra in St Saviour's Church at 7:30. A wonderful programme of English classics, conducted by guest conductor William Carslake, and starting with Vaughan Williams's overture, The Wasps. Now, he wrote this in 1909 for a production of the play The Wasps by Aristophanes at Trinity College, Cambridge. It was one of only three pieces he wrote among the hundreds of pieces of music he wrote. He only wrote three pieces of what we call incidental music, to go with something else. But the overture has become a popular orchestral piece in its own right. And as Wasps are beginning to appear, I thought you might like to hear just the beginning of Vaughan Williams's Wasps Overture.
Very busy piece.
Very busy piece. Now, one of his other great creations, Vaughan Williams, was the Fantasia on a theme of Thomas Tallis for string orchestra, which he wrote for the Three Choirs Festival in 1910 and conducted himself in Gloucester Cathedral. This is, to me, the absolute epitome of English music. I mean, it's English, an English composer based on the theme of another English composer. It's a wonderful, wonderful piece. And then they finish with Edward Elgar's First Symphony. Now, Edward Elgar had been planning to write a symphony for 10 years, and the first performance of his First Symphony was an immediate and phenomenal success, one critic describing it as the finest masterpiece of its type ever to have come from an English composer. The St. Albans Symphony Orchestra finishes its concert with it on the 11th of May in St. Saviour's. Hans Richter, to whom it was dedicated, conducted the Halle Orchestra in Manchester on its first performance in December 1908, and then conducted it 4 days later in London with the London Symphony Orchestra. So both Manchester and London got to hear the piece very quickly, one after the other. 10 years before, Elgar had had the idea of writing a symphony to commemorate General Gordon's victory at Khartoum, just as Beethoven had done with Bonaparte and the Eureka Symphony. Mm. In 1899, he wrote to his friend August Jaeger, who was the Nimrod of Elgar Variations, "Now, as to Gordon, the thing possesses me, but I can't write it down yet." And then, a bit later on, in 1905, Elgar gave a lecture on Brahms's Third Symphony and said that he didn't care for it when music was a description of something else. And so he decided to avoid writing programmatic music and write purely in the abstract, just as Brahms had done. And he wrote to Ernest Newman, the critic, that the new symphony was nothing to do with Gordon, and to Walfer Davis, who was a fellow composer, that there is no programme beyond a wide experience of human life and a massive hope in the future. This first symphony of Elgar, who only completed two symphonies, is indeed a wonderful piece. And I thought you might like to hear a little bit of it. So here's the beginning of the second movement.
So that's the start of the second movement of Elgar's Symphony No. 1. So two lovely concerts there, actually. I'll just recap that last one that we've been talking about. Saturday the 11th of the May is the date. St. Albans Symphony Orchestra will be playing at St. Saviour's Church, which is on Sandpit Lane, starting at 7:30. The other concert we talked about earlier is in Harpenden at St. John's Church, and the music makers of Harpenden are doing a concert all around the theme of love called Song of Songs. So a nice opportunity and good thing to choose between.
I think so, yes.
Nice evening out. So the following day, Sunday the 12th of May, head to Hatfield if you want some music to enjoy. The Western Auditorium at the University is the venue for the de Havilland Philharmonic Orchestra. This time they're performing in the evening.
They are, 7:30, and they quite often perform in the afternoon, but this one seems to be in the evening. They start with the Rossini, the Barber of Seville overture. This overture was in fact recycled from a couple of other operas, because Rossini wrote the Barber of Seville in an astonishing 12 days. The story was taken from Beaumarchais' Le Mariage de Figaro, and of course the story was used by Mozart as well. The title of the opera when he first produced it was The Barber of Seville or The Useless Precaution, though that bit of the title was dropped fairly quickly because it became a great success and is regarded as one of the finest opera buffa ever written. Rossini's music is very florid and beloved of sopranos, who use it as an opportunity to show off their technique. The famous soprano Adelina Patti, one of the great divas of her day, once sang a performance after which Rossini said to her, Very nice, my dear. And who wrote the piece that you have just performed? So she obviously took rather a lot of liberties with it. Anyway, here is the Barbara of Seville overture.
It always strikes me as being quite frantic, that.
Yes, it is. It is. Yes.
And also in the concert, some Haydn.
Yes. Haydn's first cello concerto, written in the 1760s and then lost until it was rediscovered in the Prague National Museum in the 1960s, 200 years later. It's extraordinary. It's now a staple of the cello repertoire and on this occasion will be performed by the orchestra's principal cellist, Tim Stegels. And they finish with Brahms' great first symphony. Brahms took 14 years to complete it, feeling that he was in the shadow of Beethoven, but the piece was a success, despite being described by the eminent conductor Hans von Bülow as Beethoven's 10th, an unfortunate label which seems to have stuck to the symphony. Mm. But it is a wonderful piece. It is a substantial work, lasting around 3/4 of an hour. Here is the start of the first movement, and you know you're in for something fairly monumental.
Good start to the Symphony No. 1 of Brahms. Mm. And that's the concert on Sunday, the 12th of May, at the Western Auditorium in the University of Hatfield. The de Havilland Philharmonic Orchestra are performing. It starts at 7:30. Then we're moving on to Friday, the 17th of May, back in St. Albans. And this is St. Albans Chamber Opera Company.
Yes, they're reprising the performance they gave in October, which was called An Evening with Mr. Gilbert and Mr. Sullivan, which they gave in the Abbey Theatre studio. Those performances sold out, so they are giving audiences another chance to hear the programme. It includes many popular songs and choruses from the operettas, and the part of W.S. Gilbert is played by Stephen De Silva, and that of Arthur Sullivan by Peter Kestner, the chairman of the company and the director of their recently successful Ruddy Gore production. So if you like Gilbert and Sullivan, this is the evening for you. Abbey Theatre Studio, Friday the 17th of May at 7:30.
Then finally for this month, Saturday the 18th of May, St. Saviour's Church again is the venue for a concert, this time given by Amadeus Chamber Orchestra.
Yes, yes. This is another lovely, lovely programme, music by Mozart, Haydn and Beethoven. It's conducted by Joel Sandelson, who is assistant conductor of the BBC Scottish Symphony Orchestra. After Simon Thompson conducted the orchestra for about 20 years, they've had a series of guest conductors, which is produced some rather interesting results, and I'm sure they've all enjoyed playing for them. The first piece in the programme is Mozart's Symphony No. 35, the Hafner. This was written in 1782, when Mozart was 26, for the occasion of the ennoblement of Sigmund Hafner. Now, the Hafner family were a prominent Salzburg family, the father having been mayor. The Mozart family and the Hafner family knew each other, and the Hafners had in fact helped out with the financing of Mozart's early European tours. 6 years earlier, Mozart had written a serenade for them, now known as the Hafner Serenade, and when this ceremony came along and the request for some music, Mozart was unfortunately up to his ears with work, teaching and an impending marriage, so he simply rejigged some of the serenade music he had written before and added an introductory march and a minuet, and the result was one of the most popular symphonies he wrote, Symphony No. 35, the Hafner. And here's the beginning of it.
So the family were obviously very pleased with the results.
I'm sure they were. I'm sure that who wouldn't be?
No.
Now, one of the anomalies comes up this month because also in this programme is Haydn's second cello concerto. So you can hear both Haydn cello concertos within the month.
Wow.
And amazingly enough, this one also got lost for about 200 years. It was written, Haydn wrote it for a cellist in the Esterházy Orchestra, and there was some doubt among scholars as to whether the piece was indeed by Haydn or by this cellist, who was called Antonín Kraft. Anyway, the autograph score eventually turned up in 1951, and Haydn was confirmed as the composer. It's really strange that both cello concertos got lost and were both found in the 20th century.
Yes,
anyway.
And I mean, you know, in the 1950s as well. It took an awful long time to emerge, didn't it?
It did. Yeah, it's a lovely concerto. It sounds somewhat more relaxed and lyrical than its predecessor, but it is technically more difficult for the soloist. But Haydn's music never fails to give pleasure, and this concerto is no exception. And then they finished the concert with Beethoven's First Symphony. Beethoven premiered his First Symphony at his first benefit concert in Vienna in April 1800. It, of course, owed much to his predecessors, Haydn and Mozart, and was rather classical in style, but with hints of Beethoven's creative genius, which was still to be fully revealed. This, remember, was only a year before 1801, when he discovered that he was going deaf. And this catastrophic event for a musician only seemed to stir him on to greater efforts. As we know, he wrote 9 symphonies, and there are few who'd argue that they were the greatest symphonies ever written. This was certainly my father's opinion. He thought that Beethoven was the greatest composer who ever lived, and I grew up with all the Beethoven symphonies on 78s.
Yes. We had lots of discs.
And he had a wonderful one, these HMV horns.
Oh, really?
We played it on, yes. He was very proud of that. Anyway, it wasn't until years later, when as a music student, that it really dawned on me how amazing a composer Beethoven was. Because I remember sitting in my room one afternoon listening to the 9th Symphony. And the thought suddenly dawned on me that actually, if you had only heard up to all the music that had been written up to that point, the 9th Symphony is absolutely a wild and revolutionary piece. It's just completely different from everything that's gone before. Mm. It sometimes seems a pity that we can never recapture the excitement which the first hearers of Beethoven's music must have done.
Mm.
In fact, it's a bit of a problem for performers and audiences, really, that when you listen to a piece of music, you should try and put out of your mind everything that came after it and hear it as it were fresh. I mean, this is impossible for us to do now, living in the 21st century.
Yeah.
But as a performer, you have to try and do that. So if you're singing Palestrina or Beethoven or anything, you should try and approach it as if you were doing it at the time when it was written, you know, when it was fresh. Very difficult to do. But I think that's what sometimes makes performances of Beethoven and Haydn and Mozart really stand out, because they come to us as really fresh. Anyway, so for those of you who prefer orchestral to choral music, this is a bit of a vintage month, with several lovely concerts featuring music by the greatest of composers. And just to play us out, I thought you might like to hear the start of the 3rd movement of Beethoven's First Symphony.
Just the start of his symphonic works is amazing.
Mm.
Yeah. So that concert, Saturday the 18th of May, is at St. Saviour's Church on Sandpit Lane in St. Albans. 7:30 is the starting time, and the Amadeus Chamber Orchestra will be performing. So that's our roundup for May. We'll be back in a few weeks' time to look further ahead. And thank you very much, David Ireson, for joining me today. And if you go to the concerts, enjoy listening to them.
Indeed.
Finally, we have our piece of music, Piano Swing Boogie by Goffby, in its entirety. Many thanks to our readers today, especially to Angela, who, as usual, provided the radio listings. And also to Monty and John, who make all the copies of the programme and arrange to get yours to you. And we'll be back again next month. But that's all from News Extra in April 2019. Goodbye.